This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Conversation with Phoebe Smith. Please welcome Leveson Wood.
Ooh. We'll move this out of the way.
What are they doing there? Thank you.
Oh, thanks everyone for coming. Staying around for last thing on a Sunday, eh? Well, I am so pleased to be here with Lev. And I want to start, first of all, actually, to taking you back a few years. I think the year was 2013, and I was at an event in London. There was a climber called Leo Holding who was launching one of his films with Al Lee. And a young man called Leveson Wood came up to me and introduced himself and said, hey, I'm going to walk the Nile. And I said, yeah, come back and tell me when you've done it. I was the editor of a travel magazine at the time, and a lot of people told me they were going to do a lot of big things.
Yeah.
And I obviously didn't believe it. And then you did it. So I think this latest journey that we've just seen the video of, you know, you've gone somewhere purposely that the headlines are showing as being quite negative. Do you have a knack for doing things people tell you not to do, or that you won't do?
I think, in a word, yes. That's kind of what I wanted to do ever since, like you say, the Nile journey. That was, you know, literally everyone I said that I was going to do this journey to, yeah, they all said, no, it's impossible, you're going to die. Except my mum, who said, have a lovely holiday. Sadly.
When are you going to get a real job?
But, you know, it was, for me, it was that really proved the realm of possibility for me, because it was something that nobody really believed in. At times, you know, even myself, I did think, is this even possible? And the truth is, I didn't know if it was possible or not, but I knew that I'd never forgive myself if I didn't try.
And you've got to give it a go.
Exactly. And ever since then, I mean, I've kind of been building up to this journey. This has been a journey that's been at the back of my mind for a very long time.
Since you were sort of 19?
Yeah. I mean, I first travelled in the Middle East. Well, I was 2003, so I was 21.
Yeah.
And it was the summer of 2003, which, of course, was the year of the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And I was just on a backpacking holiday with my mates in Egypt. And we travelled around Egypt and Israel. And due to some unforeseen circumstances, basically a bomb went off in Jerusalem, which meant that Israel closed all its borders. So we were kind of stuck. And we were told to leave the country. And the only border that was open was to the east, in completely the wrong direction, to Jordan. And myself and my friend Alex, we were thinking, well, we could just fly home, or we could fly to Europe, but one, we didn't have any money, and two, both of our parents thought we were on holiday in Greece at the time.
Aha.
So we thought, okay, we can't admit where we are, so we'll go towards Jordan. We got to Jordan, another bomb went off, this time in Baghdad. Jordan closed its borders, meaning that we were really stuck. So at this stage, the only border that was open with Jordan was actually into Iraq itself, because of course the Americans were on the border.
Yeah.
So being young and foolish, we hitchhiked east to the Iraqi border, where a young American National Guardsman tried to sell us his gun. And then,
did you buy it? Was it
no, didn't
price?
Buy it, chose not to. But we took a taxi across the Syrian desert all the way to Baghdad. And then had to hitchhike across Baghdad. You know, this was when Saddam Hussein was still hiding down his little hole.
Yeah.
Very turbulent times. But ever since that moment, you know, what stuck with me from that very formative journey was this amazing sense of hospitality. Even in the middle of a war zone, we were looked after incredibly well by local people. And ever since then, and having done lots of other journeys since then, I thought, why not go back to the region that I had been so well looked after and try and show it through a different lens, rather than the usual lazy media narrative of the Middle East as just this big empty desert,
this dangerous place that you shouldn't go to.
Exactly.
And so obviously we had walking the Nile, we had walking the Himalaya, walking the Americas. This is not walking Arabia.
No.
Well, so how did you get around? Because it's a sort of circumnavigation, isn't it, of the Middle East, basically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically, so the last televised journey I did was Russia to Iran, and that wasn't walking either, so that was sort of by any means. I mean, what I discovered from the walking journeys were, it was a great sort of device, effectively, to get from A to B. You know, for me, it was never about the endurance.
Yeah.
Hands up, I don't necessarily even like walking that much. You know, it's like
I think I've read that somewhere. Yeah, you
know, I don't mind it. It's not, I'm not that passionate about it. But for me, it's not about the walking. It's about the travelling. It's about the experience of embedding yourself in other cultures and meeting interesting people. So, for the latest journeys, I wanted to embed myself with and travel sort of my own. Sort of self-written rules were travel the way that the local people do.
Okay.
A lot of that was walking, so I walked vast swathes of the Middle East, but at times, you know, there's empty, big empty deserts, why not take a camel? So,
That's always my first thought, why not take a camel?
Exactly. At times, in places like Iraq, you know, the only way to travel was jumping on the back of a tank. And so it was a mixture, but ultimately it was a way of meeting interesting people and telling, you know, the story of the Middle East through their eyes.
Because if you'd have walked it, of course, it would have taken a lot longer, because it took you, what, about 5 or 6 months to complete this. And the idea came to properly do it, as most the best ideas in the world came, was in a pub with your friends.
As ever.
Without, you know, being rude about it, you know, if we look at your other journeys, you know, we know there was obviously the awful thing with heatstroke and obviously with Matt. We know you had that awful accident in the Himalaya. How on earth do you convince people to travel with you?
That's a very good question. Well, I think I'd run out of friends at this stage. So Dave and Simon were the two friends I had that were, well, A, you know, didn't have a proper job,
and
B, had that sense of adventure. the reality is, you know, I've got a very supportive group of friends and colleagues, people that I trust and work with, cameramen, guys from the army who I've worked with for a very long time.
Yeah.
And we're all, you know, cut from the same cloth, really. You know, I'm sure lots of people in this room have that same mentality. You know, it's assessing risk for what it really is. And just because a country is called Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq or Yemen, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go and, you know, get killed the moment you cross the border. You know, everything's localized.
Yeah.
And that really is the ultimate message that I'm trying to tell in this book and my other books, is that, you know, don't tar a whole country with the same brush. You know?
Don't just read a headline and assume that's what it's like.
Exactly.
And do you think, because obviously you have the military background, but you also have the journalistic background, do you think those two things together is what has helped you do that? Because some people go, it's just not worth the risk.
Mm.
And even you in the book, sort of, when your friends suddenly get behind you, a bit like, I'm not sure I want to do this. So do you think that's helped you be able to assess risk and stay safe while you're going to these places?
I think so. I think understanding what risk is, and like I say, it's often not the more glamorous side of things, getting shot at by ISIS or, you know, being chomped by a crocodile. It's often really the more banal things, getting ill, you know, getting food poisoning.
Traveller's diarrhea is probably the worst thing and the most likely thing.
Well, yeah, that and road traffic accidents. Having been in a car accident and having been in quite a few myself, you know, that is the most common form of injury and worse. So it's remembering that, and actually remembering also that in these countries that I travel to, there are millions and millions of people living there.
Mm.
They're not all fighting at the same time.
No.
Frankly, it's usually a very small portion. That's not in any way to undermine the tragedy of the conflict in places like Syria, but it's just giving things in perspective.
Well, and that they're as horrified as what they're seeing in their media as we all are, and they want to change that perspective. And you talk in the book about how that you dress. I mean, was that really important to be accepted? Because you sort of said you could get away with almost kind of walking around these streets looking almost Arabic.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helps in certain places. I mean, in places like Yemen, we had to cross a border without a passport stamp, you know, not technically above board, I suppose. And the only way to do that is to sit in the back of the car, wear the local dress, try and blend in and not... you know, not sort of stand out like a sore thumb.
Although you did a little bit, because word came out that there was a British spy, didn't there, when you were in Yemen, and you had to make a sharp exit.
Well, yeah, the Yemen national newspaper actually reported the presence of a British spy in eastern Yemen trying to create an independent state.
Yeah.
When I told the local tribal chief that I thought that was very unlikely, he said, no, they're referring to you. At which point he then suggested that it was time to leave because the Saudis were in all likelihood going to drone strike the hotel that we were in. So it was time to leave. So we had to do a runner. Yeah.
And you talk about, obviously, the local people, which add so much to a place, and like you said, really show what a place is like beyond those headlines. Mm-hmm. And you have a very sort of unique way of finding guides, and you had... there was one guide who was the older lady. Was it in Syria?
Nada, yeah.
Yeah, and how did you find her, and how did she make it different from, say, a normal guide?
Well, I tried to just get as diverse a range of people. I mean, often, though, it wasn't, you know, you get who you're given. For Syria, we were told that the best guide in the country was this lady called Nada. She was a grandmother.
Yeah.
And in a place like Syria, which is so fractured, actually having a male guide, you know, you're often inviting a bit of trouble because, you know, he has to be affiliated to someone, one group, or whether it's government or the rebels or one of the various factions there. Whereas if you're travelling with, you know, this sort of little lady who is wearing the hijab and so on, actually, we got to these army roadblocks, you know, full of men with guns, and she just told them to bugger off, and it was great. You know, we got access
to everything.
Like they'd
been told off by their mum or someone.
Yeah, and it actually really helped. And so it wasn't so much, you know, I wasn't sort of trying to sort of necessarily... for me, it was great to have a woman on board and great to have a woman with such force behind her. But, the way I find guides can be anything from recommendations from local journalists or NGO workers through to literally go on Instagram and seeing who the local, you know, photographer is.
Who can get you access to that. And interesting, speaking of women, so obviously in all your adventures we've seen you, and it tends to be with, obviously you're going with friends, you're going with people you know and trust. Have you ever considered travelling and doing these things with a woman? Because do you think that might change things in a way and get you... I remember watching the wonderful documentary with Palin, for instance, and him getting to this village in Pakistan, and he couldn't go beyond this wall and this gate because he was a man. And I often thought, I wonder if he'd had a woman presenter with him as well, that we could have all suddenly opened up this other world. I mean, is that something you would consider?
No, absolutely, yeah. Any volunteers, I'm more than happy to...
Well, it's funny you should mention that also, because I do recall there was a headline in The Guardian in March of 2018 saying that after my next big adventure, I'm going on a wife hunt. So, Lev, how's that going?
All I'd say on that is...
lots of women here would like to know.
Is don't believe everything you read in the newspapers. That's the motto of my books. And
is that your next
goes
book?
Goes for that particular.
And you know, you've mentioned before about you're not that keen on flying, and there was that you had to avoid Yemen and go on a boat, and you got seasick. Do you think you're a natural traveller?
Well, so that sort of particular detour was having just been thrown out of Yemen. I didn't want to fly it. Well, for one reason, I didn't have a visa for Saudi Arabia at this point.
Yeah.
So the only way to get around the coast of Yemen was to try and find a boat. So I spent about a week in this town called Salalah, asking around all of the big commercial oil tanker companies, you know, Maersk and all that. And they all said, absolutely not, we're not picking you up.
Yeah.
I eventually had to sort of lower my expectations, and I found this guy down at the beach who was like a local fisherman. He owned a couple of boats or had contacts down there. His name was Aladdin. He said he could work his magic and get me on a boat, which is great. So it was just this wooden fishing dhow. And the idea was to go around Yemen, up the coast of the Red Sea, and then get access to Saudi Arabia that way. But at the very least, to get to the Horn of Africa, to Djibouti, from where I could try and get a visa. The only problem was this boat was owned by a Somali guy who may or may not have been a pirate himself. And he was in the business of smuggling condensed milk into Somalia. So I got on this boat, and none of the crew could speak any English. And 5 days across the Gulf of Aden, and we were dropped off, not in Saudi Arabia or indeed Djibouti, but actually just off the coast of Somalia, which is, you know, some of the most heavily pirated waters in the world.
Yeah.
But luckily, if you're travelling with the pirates, then you're kind of in good hands.
You have safe passage, yeah.
So it ended up being all right. So we hitchhiked across Somalia, and we were looked after quite well.
And do you think, I mean, this is always a thing, and you know, I've asked people who travel a lot to these sort of places before, you know, you're going somewhere, like you said, your mission is to kind of showcase a different side to the headlines you see. But do you think you bring any other value to it other than that? Because obviously what these people need is actually help, don't they? They need tourists, they need money, they need that. Do you think what you do actually does do that? Do you have a bit of a guilty conscience sometimes that, am I actually helping? Am I making things better or worse? How do you feel about that?
Well, For me, there is an element of the sort of traveller's guilt, I suppose. You know, is what I'm doing of any use to anyone? Mm. But before I did this, I ran a little expedition company, sure. and I saw, you know, the real benefit. I think the travel industry, and for those of you that work in it, I think has an enormous impact. It's sustainable for the most part. I think it puts money directly into the pockets of local people. So the more travel, and ultimately it encourages dialogue and communication between communities. So when you go to another country, it's not just, you know, you seeing it, but you're acting as an ambassador for your own country as well. So I think it is actually important. And some of the more rewarding parts of my job now are actually, I mean, I went to Nepal in the wake of the 2015 earthquake.
Sure, yeah.
And I got so many nice letters from the Nepali government, charities, tour companies saying, you know, we've seen an actual upsurge in tourism to Nepal after people watched your show.
Oh, okay.
And I felt really good about that. After the Nile one, I got a letter from the head of Save the Children in East Africa.
Yeah.
Who was saying that... he literally said that we've been trying to put South Sudan on the map for 25 years.
Yeah.
And Walking the Nile did that in, you know, 1 hour. So I was pretty chuffed with that.
I know we talked before and you said you're looking to do a bit more with your charities. I mean, do you think there's something you can do with that side to help some of the places that you've been? Have you tried to highlight that? Is that part of something you're trying to do as well?
I mean, I think it's a really important part for all of us, if we're lucky enough to work in this industry, to use whatever leverage we can and contacts we can. And I certainly enjoy working with charities and you know, across the framework from conservation charities like Tusk in East Africa. I'm going out to Nepal again in April with the Gurkha Welfare Trust. Lots of different sectors, and I think, you know, it's a real privilege for me to do what I do, and I think it would be a shame not to use it to help other people. Yeah.
And obviously there's a great saying that you, when you travel, certainly I've learnt this, you never talk religion or politics. Obviously you've been travelling in a particular area for Arabia, which obviously Arabia itself doesn't actually exist, as you sort of say in the introduction to it. How difficult was it to stay neutral around that? And what, I mean, you head to Bethlehem for Christmas. I mean, are you Christian? Were you having to sort of hide that? How did you sort of navigate that?
I mean, look, it's a really complicated region.
Yes.
What I wanted to do was go as an objective observer and not be judgmental in any way. You've got to be open-minded. You've got to remove your own, whether it's prejudices or agenda or even bias to a certain extent, to go and get access. So on the one hand, I was embedded with Palestinians in the West Bank in Jericho when the U.S. Embassy was the announcement was made to relocate the U.S. Embassy. You know, the West Bank was in uproar, and, you know, we were embedded. We were filming a Palestinian riot, you know, people throwing stones at the Israeli troops. But then, to show a balanced viewpoint, you know, I was also went to go meet these hardcore Zionist settlers.
Yeah.
We went to an Israeli Defense Force military training camp where we met Israeli Special Forces. So it's trying to show both sides of the very, very complicated story.
And is it difficult, though, if you see something and think that's not...
Of course, it's very difficult.
Do you have to sort of rein that back in?
It is. I mean, going to places like Yemen, you know, where, you know, the eastern Yemen here, you know, has been hit. Well, all of Yemen has been hit incredibly tragically by not only the civil war, but the effects of the Saudi blockades, the fact that, you know, the country is completely fractured. There's 8 million people on the verge of starvation.
Yeah.
So, and I knew that a lot of that was to do with the Saudi coalition and their policy there, which in many ways, you know, the West is supporting.
Yeah.
So that was very... There was a deep conflict of interest there. But then, you know, the next destination that I was going to was Saudi Arabia, which I kind of almost wanted to dislike in some ways because I'd heard these horror stories from people who were literally starving on the streets. But, of course, when you get there and you meet the people themselves, they're incredibly welcoming.
So
you have to remember that it's the governments, actually, not the people themselves. And so... And the message that I came away from this journey was everyone, it doesn't matter which side you're on, they all want the same thing. They want to just be left alone in peace to get on with their lives.
Everyone just sort of wants to be happy. And this trip was slightly different from some of your others in that, you know, you sort of self-funded this and filmed it with your own crew rather than necessarily going out to do this TV show. How much does something like this cost?
Blimey, luck, a lot of money, actually. Well, this one was quite difficult to get backing and support for. Yeah. One, because I think a lot of people in the media thought it was too dangerous.
Yeah.
Two, I was told in no uncertain terms, you know, from a lot of broadcasters that, sorry, the Middle East isn't, something we're not interested. You know, that's just the realm of current affairs and news. Nobody wants to see people travelling in the Middle East because it goes against some of the mainstream narratives. And so I thought it was a real shame, and it gave me more determination to go and do this. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to go and fund it myself, do it. And I filmed it. I've got a 5-part series sat
ready
currently unpurchased. So if anyone out there works for the television...
if there's any backers in the room to throw some money at
you. It would be a crying shame for it not to go out on TV, because I genuinely think this is the best documentary I've ever made.
And of all the countries that you went to in the Middle East, which is the one that surprised you the most, that kind of really tested what you thought you'd see? Because obviously a few of them you'd been to before, as you said, but was there one that had either changed a lot or that really kind of shocked you because it was so much nicer or better than you thought it would be?
I mean, I was constantly, on a daily basis, having to challenge my own stereotypes and ideas. Like I say, I've travelled in the region a lot. I mean, I'd been to Syria in 2010, before the civil war.
Yeah.
So before I went back, it was the penultimate country on this journey, I was expecting the worst. I kind of fell on the foul of what we see on the news. I thought the whole country was going to be laid to waste. And it's not. Certain cities are. If you go to Homs or Aleppo, then vast swathes of the country are destroyed. But what I found was this amazing sense of hope. You know, I went to Damascus, and, you know, luckily the centre of Damascus is largely unaffected by the conflict. You know, if you go to the suburbs, a very different story. But the bizarre thing is people are just getting on with their lives. So you can go and sit down in central Damascus, have a glass of wine, because there's lots of wine bars, and, you know, there's even nightclubs in central Damascus. And literally, you can hear the mortars going off 3 or 4 miles away. But people are just...
They have
been going on for 7 years. And what surprised me the most was that sense of hope. I mean, there was one street, and I remember going to it, you know, years ago when I first went to Syria, and I wanted to go back and see if it was still there. And there was this... it's basically a street full of, just by the citadel in Damascus, that's got all the carpet sellers and all the tourist trinkets.
Yeah.
And they were still there, and I was shocked. And I saw all these guys, you know, sat outside drinking tea.
Yeah.
I said, do you sell many carpets? And they were like, nah, there's no tourists here. I was like, well, that's the obvious question. Like, what on earth are you doing open?
Yeah.
And they looked at me as if I was asking the stupid question. They said, well, of course we open. You know, we come here every morning, we put the shutters up, we put all the carpets out, we put all the stuff out for sale.
Yeah.
And he said, it was quite a profound thing, he said, you know, obviously, realistically, we know deep down that there aren't any tourists coming today, maybe not tomorrow, but one day they will return, and when they do, we need to be open waiting for them. I thought that was really...
Did you buy a carpet?
I did.
Good, I'm very, very glad to hear that. And so would you say the overriding feeling you've been left with is hope?
I think so. I mean, it's frustration and hope, because it is so complicated, far more complicated than I think most people have an understanding of.
It's very difficult to get to the root of it, definitely. Would you recommend any, other than obviously your own book, which I'm sure everyone's going to rush to buy when we finish, is there any other books that you would recommend that you maybe read before you went to help get an insight? I know you obviously looked into explorers that had been Gertrude Bell, Wilfred Thesinger.
Yeah.
Was there anyone else that you'd sort of recommend?
Well, I did. I mean, I read all of the old classics. I wanted to sort of weave in the history, not just recent history, but, you know, 19th century history, going back all the way, because this is such a historical region where the legacy, you know, goes back for thousands and thousands of years. And part of my motivation for this journey was to go and explore that myself, going to places like Jericho, Eridu, Ur, the oldest cities in the world. So I did read a lot of history in particular.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's lots of more modern books about the culture and the politics, and I didn't want to go too deep.
You didn't
want to
make that, did you?
But that's not the focus of the book. But, you know, for me, it was an opportunity to weave in all of the different strands of this very, very complicated region.
Yeah.
And hopefully people will read it and come away with at least some new ideas, or perhaps learn something new about the region that they didn't perhaps know.
Perfect. Brilliant. Well, I'm going to open the floor now to questions. We have Roddy with the microphone. So if you just want to put your hand up if you have a question for Lev. Ah, there's one over here.
Hi, Leveson. I've seen you here a few times now talking about your TV series, and they're always fantastic. I can't believe that, no, it's normally Channel 4, isn't it? I can't believe they haven't wanted to take up Arabia, because just looking at the book, it looks like it was an amazing trip. So hopefully you'll get the TV on the TV. But following Arabia now, what's your, have you got any thoughts or ideas for your next trip coming up?
I knew that was coming. What's
you
next?
You always get the next. No, you've done all that now. What's next?
So, I think I'm going to put my feet up for a little bit. No, I'm going to, I've got a few books coming out this year. I've got a children's book coming out in the summer, which is a different challenge altogether. I'm sort of looking at a photography book as well that sort of looks at all of the journeys, and a couple of other projects which I can't really talk about at the moment. But that combined with doing a bit more of the focus on some of the charities that I work with. I don't have any big expeditions in the pipeline just yet, but yeah, lots more writing.
Do you walk for fun ever now?
Do I walk for fun?
Yeah. Do you?
Well, I was being slightly flippant when I said I don't like walking.
Are you like so done with it that you're like, I'm not going for a walk. I'm getting the car just
well,
5 minutes down the road.
I perhaps don't need to walk for 9 months anymore. But I do. I do like to go for the little occasional stroll.
Okay. Have we got any other questions?
Thank you. Leveson, you're obviously as tough as the boots you wear. You're a strong, fit guy. Tell us a bit about the psychological and mental preparations that you make. Your journey sounds absolutely amazing. I'm currently reading your Walking the Nile book. Amazing adventure, but you must have days or times when you feel really, really uncomfortable. You're ill, you're too hot, you're too cold, you're worried about something. How do you psychologically or mentally keep yourself going to make sure that you achieve the amazing challenges that you have?
So I think, often the mental and the emotional and psychological toll is far greater than the physical one, actually, in many ways. And I think the only way to get over it is, well, twofold. I think one is keeping everything in perspective. And because I often travel in places that there is, inevitably poverty or conflict, you don't have time to have too much self-pity, because you look around, and particularly when you're shown incredible hospitality and warmth. You mentioned walking the Nile. You know, Sudan was a prime example. You know, Sudan is, stricken with poverty. But actually, the people I met in Sudan were some of the most welcoming, friendly people I've seen anywhere in the world, and they would literally rather die than not give you their last glass of water. You know, that's how amazing the people are there. And I found that everywhere. You know, I didn't have too much time to feel sorry for myself. So there's that side of things. But also, I think just maintaining a sense of humour, actually. And I try and surround myself with funny people, and the guys that I work with. You know, the cameraman, and I try and choose. You know, my definition or parameters for a good guide is really somebody who can make me laugh. You know, that's all that matters. I don't need somebody who can use a compass or even knows the way, because usually they get lost anyway. It's about having somebody that you can get on with, have some fun with, have a bit of banter, and that sense of humour is really important to me, and finding something funny in every situation. I mean, one example, talked about Syria quite a lot, and it's in the book. For those that haven't read it, I will spoil it. I'll tell you the story. It was we were in Syria. It was on one of the last days in Syria. We were travelling, I think, from Homs down to Damascus, right on the front line against ISIS. This empty desert road, but it was quite nerve-wracking because there was about 30 or 40 miles where that was, that's ISIS territory. This is government controlled, and there was like blown-up tanks and stuff at the side of the road, and we were running low on fuel. So we thought, okay, we need to stop at the next place. And luckily, there was kind of like a little service station at the side of the road. Now, it wasn't quite like the ones that you get on the M1, but it was a broken old fuel pump. But there was a guy there with a few jerry cans. And so, just when we stopped, Nada, who was the lady guide, she went off to use the loo. So I was stood there, and there was a little coffee shop type thing. So I walked in and just about to order a coffee. and I heard this noise behind, and a coach pulled up behind me in the forecourt. I was like, oh, I wonder who that is. And I turned around, and about 50 guys jumped off this coach, and they were all this ragtag collection. Some of them were in uniform, some weren't. They all had long black hair, bandanas, big beards, AK-47s, rocket launchers. I thought, blimey, this must be ISIS, you know. So I was terrified. And one of these guys, and I thought at this point, okay, well, my guide's gone to the loo. I'm stood there on my own. I don't speak much Arabic. So I kind of shuffled off into the corner. And these guys walked in and started ordering their coffee. And one of them came over to me and said, Salam alaikum. And I said, Wa alaikum salam. And then he said something else in Arabic, and I had no idea what he was talking about. So he looked at me and said, in perfect English, so where are you from then? So I thought, okay, this is Jihadi John or something. And, you know, I was pretty nervous at this stage. And I said, well, I thought there's no point in lying. I said, I'm from England. He looked at me again and said, oh, I really like England. I've been there a few times. I thought, I bet you have. And I thought, I'll put the question back to him. I said, so who are you guys? He said, oh, we're ISIS. At which point, my face went white. My trousers went another colour. And then he burst into this chuckle and slapped me on the back. Said, I'm only joking, mate. Not really. We're all Hezbollah. And they were. So they'd come from Lebanon, and they were all volunteer fighters who'd come to fight against ISIS. But anyway, he bought me a coffee, and we had a bit of a giggle. And he explained about, you know, for him, he was only 18. And he'd said, you know, it's a bit like... And he'd actually spent quite a bit of time in England. And he said that for him, Hezbollah, it's a bit like going on a gap year, because you get to travel for 6 months, go and fight ISIS, and then go back to university. And I said, OK, which university are you going to? He said, well, I'm just doing my UCAS form for Leeds at the moment, actually. So it's one of those surreal experiences of my life. But it's those, like funny situations in the most bizarre circumstances that make these journeys. So, hey? Well, exactly.
I thought you were going to say he started talking, he was from Bolton or something.
Yeah, well, he did.
Was there another question over here, Roddy?
Levison, what made you switch from army life to travel writer and explorer life?
Thank you, that's a very good question. So I spent 5 years in the army, in the regular army, in the parachute regiment, and, you know, I don't think I was cut out for being ordered around, being told what to do. I think really, I just, you know, I felt as though 5 years was quite a long time. I'd done what I wanted to do. I had a great time in the army. I'd made lots of very good friends. But I wanted a new challenge, and I enjoyed travelling. And, you know, with the army, you do get to travel, but not quite the same. And I wanted a bit more freedom. And so I decided that, you know, what was I good at? Well, I was good at sort of travelling, I was good at writing, I was good at photography. Why not bring those hobbies together and try and, you know, do what I loved and what I'd always wanted to do ever since I was probably your age was write a book. And so that was my aim, you know, and I sort of got the experience with the army, and I thought, let's give it a go, now or never. And I did, and luckily it worked out.
Any other questions? Over that.
What would your advice be for someone who's looking to go and, say, hitchhike in a region like the Middle East, which is really unpredictable? Let's put it that way, I suppose.
I'd say just go and do it. Yeah. my big hitchhiking adventures was when I was 22. I'd just graduated from university. I studied history, but my speciality was travel literature and great overland journeys, so the Silk Road, you know, the big pilgrimages and so on. So I thought, you know, I need to put my money where my mouth is and go on a big overland journey myself. So I decided that I was going to go and hitchhike the length of the Silk Road all the way to India. And that's what I did. You know, I sort of told my mum I was going on holiday to Greece again and put my thumb up at Grantham Services on the A1. And got down to Calais and then carried on east. And it was at that age, you know, I'm probably not sure if I'd do it now, but at that age it was just the most amazing experience. I did it the whole journey, 5 months, on a budget of 750 quid, and that included the flight home. And that was just sleeping rough at the side of the road. It was, you know, catching up with mates in Europe that I'd sort of, you know, met at university. And then, you know, as soon as you get as far as Turkey, things become cheap. And, it was the most amazing experience. You know, there were days and days where I didn't eat because I couldn't afford to. But it was that experience, I think, that gave me the confidence to do these later journeys, because I got this real sense that even in places that have got a bad rep, this kindness of strangers really pervades every society. So I'd say, yeah, go and do it. You know,
especially because the Middle East is, it's a phrase, the Middle East, but it's such a huge area. Places like Jordan are super safe. I've hitchhiked in Jordan and in Oman as a woman on my own, and I think people, like you said, it's almost they tarnish it with this one image that covers a multitude of countries, a multitude of peoples, which... have you ever actually been to Greece, I have to ask?
I have been to Greece, yeah.
So you can blag...
Not as many times as my mum thinks.
We probably have time for maybe one more question. Is there another person?
There's a gentleman down there, or...?
Oh, we might be able to squeeze into
okay.
you, yeah.
Sorry, what were the top three countries that you would suggest visiting, and why?
Ooh, top three. That's very tough. I don't know if I can narrow it down to three. I mean, on this journey, Lebanon was amazing. I mean, I was only there for like a week, but I'd love to go back. I mean, you can go skiing in Lebanon. Sudan, I have to say, was just a real highlight because of the culture and the people, and it's just this amazing, beautiful country. Nepal, I love, and I keep going back to Nepal. I mean, I could reel them off, but I'll go for those three for now.
And then, so did we have one last question?
Ooh, no pressure. The Hunza Valley in Pakistan is beautiful.
No pressure. This is the last one, so you've got to make it.
Sorry, this
amazing.
Chap sat down in the middle. He hasn't even got a seat, and he doesn't get his question.
Oh.
We'll do two.
We'll do two, right. But make them amazing.
Okay, it's an amazing question. Where do you like to go on holiday now? Is it like Benidorm, the Isle of Wight, Malaya?
Well, I went to Ibiza last summer. That was good fun. And I'm going to Bali in March.
And here we go.
Go on, yeah.
I was just going to ask, when did you first start writing, and how do you practice your craft?
Okay, when did I first start writing? Well, you know, I did a history degree, so that's kind of, you know, knocking out a few essays here and there. But really, it was kind of when in my last couple of years in the army, I thought, you know, I was reading, you know, Lonely Planet and Brad Guides and all these guidebooks, and thinking, I'm sure that's just made up. And I'm not saying it is, but like at the time, it just gave me this impetus I really wanted to be a travel writer. I think I was just jealous of the people that got to write these guidebooks, really. And so I thought, you know, that's where I can start. So I did. I started submitting articles to those publications, to newspapers. Obviously, they all got turned down. For ages and ages, you know, you've got to deal with rejection on a daily basis. You know, so the book about my hitchhike to India, I actually wrote that in when I just left the army. I spent 12 months writing, and then of course I pitched it out to dozens and dozens of publishers.
As you do.
Yeah, and they all said no.
But it's that thing about someone tells you you can't do it.
Yeah.
You're going to do it.
Well, I mean, the manuscript sat on my laptop for, I think it was 10 years.
Yeah.
And it was only after I'd written three books that the publishers were like, okay, what do you want to do next? And I said, well, I've got this, I've got 100,000 words on my laptop, actually. And then it got published. So actually, that was sort of, for me, a really important thing to write. But I think it's just a case of plugging away. You know, there's not a great deal of money in writing, unless you're J.K. Rowling, but like, you know, it's an enjoyable thing. I love it, and I don't, you know, I think it's a noble pursuit. If people read your books and you can get your opinion out there, and people enjoy it, and people are entertained, then I think there's something to be said for that.
And I'll ask you, in the last thing to ask you, Arabia, three words. How would you sum it up?
Enigmatic and bloody hot.
Well, and on that note, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Lev. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Phoebe.
And, of course, Lev will be signing books, posing for selfies. On the hunt for a wife. All of you above over there. So thank you all very much. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
You.